Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday, Thanksgiving Eve. All right, let's get to it here. Today, we're in the Sunbury Motors Studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Kia Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Adam Bittner, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, in just a few minutes. And then we'll have Chris Soleri on from the Lansing State Journal in the final half hour. First of all, our play-by-play call of the day. Last night, it was the Golden State Warriors and the Lakers, and the Lakers made it very easy for Stephen Curry.
Now, 3 for 13 from the floor. Oh, the move by Curry. It'll go straight down the lane.
Marv Albert with the call last night on TNT as the Warriors roll on. What an incredible start for the defending NBA champions. And Stephen Curry is off to a great start in this 15-16 season. Penn State football coming up Saturday. The game will be at East Lansing. We do not know whether Connor Cook will play in the game or not. Cook is a game-time decision, which indicates to me that I don't think he's going to make it. I think we might see Tyler O'Connor on Saturday. But without Connor Cook, they went into East Lansing and they won on Saturday, beating Ohio State. Adam Bittner, of course, was at the Penn State-Michigan game where Michigan beat the Nittany Lions 28-16. Adam, of course, formerly with the Daily Collegiate and now with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Adam, welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Hey, Steve. Great to be back.
All right. Your thoughts on what you saw Saturday at Beaver Stadium?
Well, honestly, I felt like a lot of what I saw Saturday is stuff that we've been seeing all season. Special teams issues kind of reared their ugly head. And I think, you know, the big problem that continues to be a problem is this team kind of puts itself behind the eight ball in terms of field position. I think, you know, to that, the muff punt that resulted in a Michigan touchdown that was, you know, largely, you know, the difference in the game and the way the game played out from there. I think about that and Penn State, you know, if it had moved the ball, even, you know, 20 yards on the drive before the punt and Michigan had been a little further back down the field, then maybe a muff punt at the 30 isn't as disastrous as a muff punt inside the 10. And you give yourself your defense, which has been solid all day and has been solid all season, you know, a chance to, you know, maybe salvage a field goal rather than giving up a touchdown. But instead, you know, Penn State has been pinned deep and has been often unable to, you know, not even necessarily put a scoring drive together, but do enough just to change the field and give your defense a chance to not play without its backup against the wall. So, you know, I think, you know, it wasn't really like a new defeat. A lot of the issues that have been there all season were there on Saturday. You know, it'll be interesting to see how they respond against Michigan State.
Yeah, no question. In fact, 6 of the 11 Penn State drives started inside the 25-yard line. And that's that, you know, in fact, the 4 losses this year, Penn State is down 11 yards per possession on field position. It's played a pretty big role so far in this one. 49 yards on the last two Michigan touchdowns, one the muff punt that you just referenced, and the other on that kickoff return out to the 40-yard line. It seems like they, you know, again, and I talked about this earlier, how thin is this team's margin of error after watching them now for 11 games?
You know, I think it depends upon which unit you're talking about. I feel like the defense has a really razor thin margin of error because so often they're being set up in positions like that where, you know, they have to get stops with their backs up against the wall. And for the offense, it doesn't seem like the bar is in the same place because they kind of know in the back of their minds that, you know, the defense can bail them out of a lot of situations. So, you know, overall, where is that margin of error? I'm not sure. But I think it's two different things for the two different units because, you know, one is so solid and one, you know, often struggles at times. And obviously we've seen Penn State's offense do some solid things this season at times. But when Penn State has struggled as a team, it's consistently been for the reasons you mentioned, with field position and not maybe getting the most out of that defensive unit by putting it in bad positions.
What do you think of the fact that on a day where the students didn't have to be there because classes ended on Friday, that student section was, by the end of the game, it was filled, and there was 107,000-plus in that stadium for that game?
I think, you know, in my 4 years at Penn State, I never would have thought to miss a game like the Michigan game. I mean, so often you sit through the non-conference games that are against opponents that really are pretty underwhelming. And this season was really no exception for the home slate. This is what you pay those big bucks for. It is to get the atmosphere of a big game against Michigan. Last season you had Ohio State and Michigan State roll through. Those are the days that you live for, you know, if you're a college football fan, at least in my opinion. So I'm not sure why the extra 24 hours at home would be incentive to leave that behind. Maybe I should be surprised, but you know, to me it just seems like such an obvious decision to hang in there for a game like this. I think it's a little different when you're talking about, you know, maybe going back up after Thanksgiving break, cutting your stay at home a little bit short. You got all this stuff going on next weekend with Thanksgiving. But in terms of, you know, going home this week, you know, I thought this is what you live for if you're a college football fan.
As a former student, Adam, I couldn't agree more. I never even considered missing a game in my 4 years here. I don't think I did miss a game in my 4 years here. So, I mean, I just couldn't imagine, you know, leaving early to miss a game like that, you know.
No offense, but as someone who sits and glances over at the section once in a while for a noon game, I didn't know what to expect, in all fairness.
That's true.
No, I did not.
That's true,
okay.
Sometimes.
All right. I mean, in all fairness, all the tickets are sold. They're all sold, okay? I don't know what to expect on a noon game anymore when I look over at that section. I don't know.
That's very true. But I think, you know, in some cases, again, you get into the opponents that aren't necessarily inspiring a ton of confidence or interest, really, and people like to tailgate a little bit longer, and they like to take their time getting in. But you know, I think for a game like this, that you know that this is what you wait for all year is a game like this or a game like the Rutgers game. You know, when you know it's a night game, you have that spectacular atmosphere. You only get that a couple days a year, and you have to take advantage of it while it's on the table.
Well, in all honesty, are there only like 15 of those kind of opponents nationally?
I think there would probably be a few more
than 15.
Than 15, I think in the Big Ten, which is the conference that's largely going to bring in those types of crowds, you probably only have three or four teams like that right now.
Aren't there just three or four teams like that in every conference? So that's 5 times 3 is 15.
That's true. That's true. But I think people also there's a curiosity factor. I remember the Oregon State game. Do you remember in 2008 there was an Oregon State game, and
yes,
they brought a ton of fans with them, and it seemed like the stadium filled up for that. I think that was a 3:30 kick. But there was a novelty factor to playing Oregon State. I think there was some curiosity there, and I think even some of those Power Five teams that are lower rungs in their conferences, just in terms of novelty, can kind of get people interested.
I agree with that. But that was supposed to be actually Arkansas State. And Penn State bought out Arkansas State because Joe thought he had a really good team that year. And he said, look, I'm going to need some RPI bump here. So he wanted to get a Power 5 team in here. Mike Riley agreed to bring them in. That's how it happened. And, I mean, it happened in a quick turnaround. It actually happened within the confines of 2008. It did not happen in 6 or 7. They actually did it that year.
I think that was the game that everybody kind of remembers is when that team, you really started to get a feeling that team was something special and had the potential to do some great things. You know, even though Oregon State was probably not the greatest opponent, just the way Penn State dismantled them, I think it made a statement.
I remember.
That
I remember.
Except, some except, of the teams on the
except guess
now.
What? Yeah. If USC loses to UCLA in the finale, guess team, which team Penn State would have played in the Rose Bowl?
Yeah.
Oregon State.
No, I remember that game well because Josh Hall, the pride of Penns Valley, you know, from my high school, had an interception in that game. So that was pretty cool because that was his first – I mean, that was towards the beginning of his, you know, playing career at Penn State. You know, he was a walk-on who got to play. So, you know, that was pretty cool, you know. But really the only major athlete to come out of my school.
Well, but you, here's the other one. Irv Pankey, who had played in the NFL for years, both of his sons – played for Oregon State, and one started, the other one played a lot. And I made a comment that Irv was now a junior college offensive line coach. And I looked at Jack and I said, Jack Ham, and I said, "Well, you can do that when you have that NFL pension." He said, "Looks at me." He says, "Well, not everybody has that NFL pension to that extent, you know." I said, "Yeah, I know you don't." He says, "How do you know?" I said, "You're sitting here with me." So. A little bit of fun. Moving forward, Michigan State. You watched Michigan State, Ohio State, or you probably heard enough about it, saw enough highlights. How impressive was that in Columbus by them?
You know, I think whenever you're playing a game without, you know, your primary quarterback, you know, a result like that is just incredibly impressive. I know Ohio State did it last season, you know, really all season, but, you know, especially down at the end, they beat a ton of great opponents with, you know, a guy who was not their primary signal caller or even their secondary signal caller. And, you know, I think anytime you can do something like that, it's very impressive and it's a bold statement. You know, and I think it kind of laid bare some flaws in Ohio State that no one else had really been able to exploit fully all season. You know, and I think, you know, it laid out some dissension in the ranks over there as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. What do you think about Elliott's comments, which were glossed over by Urban today, and also Jones tweeting after the game, "I'm done." This is quite an honest group over there.
Yeah, and I mean, as a journalist, you love that because so often we get these guys who are you know, coached and have been told what to say and what not to say, and they kind of become like replicants if you talk to too many of them. But sometimes you get those rare guys that are willing to just cut the BS and give their honest opinion, whether you agree with it or not. And I think it gives us something to talk about. You know, I think the degree to which Elliott went was probably unnecessary and unbecoming of him. You know, it's hard for me to remember a player who's so heavily criticized the staff and the coach, you know, the coach of, you know, a great coach like that, who's been through a lot and has accomplished a lot of things. But I think there's something to be said for, you know, being honest with your feelings and showing frustration and showing emotion. You know, I think that's something that's often missing a lot in today's game.
I'll say this about Elliott. My gut feeling is that he is such a competitor that he felt if he touched the ball more, he could have won the game for them. And I think that entered into part of it, if I'm going to guess. That, hey, look, I'm so confident
absolutely.
In my ability, I could have helped them win the game. So, Hey, Adam, thanks so much. Great stuff as always. Always enjoyed. Hey, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
All right, Adam Bittner, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Okay, so big day coming up tomorrow with plenty of football going on. The Eagles will take on the Detroit Lions. We've heard from Matt Leon, or as Kevin refers to him as the, quote, KYW dude. I can't wait to tell Matt that one. You know, Kevin refers to you as the KYW dude. And he related the disgust in Philadelphia. We have Brandon Gowton on the show from BleedingGreenNation.com. Stunningly, he backed up Matt's assessment of the disgust in Philadelphia. And now they have Detroit. Now, we had Jim Brandstetter on the show last week, who's not only the play-by-play voice of Michigan football, but also is the color analyst for the Detroit Lions radio network. And Jim was saying that big changes are coming in Detroit. My old friend Jim Caldwell Great guy, outstanding coach, but unless things dramatically change here in the month of December, he's going to be changed. And they have, actually, Detroit's won two games in a row, including winning a game at Green Bay. So suddenly tomorrow's game between Philadelphia and Detroit is far from a gimme, which originally on the schedule looked like this was the soft underbelly of the Eagles' schedule. With the Dolphins, the Bucks, and the Lions, it looked like the soft underbelly because then things pick up in a big way in December, including the New England Patriots. That's where the Eagles are right now, and they need to win the game tomorrow, and that is the first game tomorrow. That'll be the game on, I think, Fox tomorrow. They have that game. The second game is going to be a heck of a game. I don't care if the Cowboys have won three games or not. They're a different team with Tony Romo back in the lineup. Tony Romo will be starting tomorrow. Cam Newton and the Carolina Panthers are 10-0 in the season. The Cowboys are at home. Yes, they've won only three games, but again, different with Tony Romo out there. And that will be the second game. The third game is Green Bay at Lambeau Field taking on Chicago. Now, the Bears certainly have struggled. The Packers finally broke out of their losing streak and got back on track last week when they won at Minnesota. And the fact that it's at Lambeau on Thanksgiving night makes it even more intriguing. So that's what you have coming up tomorrow. Pretty good football all the way around. You also have Texas, Texas Tech. I mean, that's not going to really, that's not going to move the needle at all. Texas Tech's already in a bowl game. Texas has four wins. They're 4-6. They're part of that group of 17, for example, that needs to get wins to get into a bowl game. There are 71 bowl slots filled right now out of 80. Because they added two bowl games this year. They added one in Montgomery, Alabama, and they added a third bowl game in Orlando. Why does Orlando need three bowl games? Why does any city need more than one bowl game? That I don't get. I don't get why any city needs more than one bowl game. Phoenix has two. Obviously, you have Dallas has two. And, of course, Fort Worth's right there as well. So that's really three in the same metro area. San Diego has two, and Orlando has three bowl games. Are you kidding me? All right, well, but that creates a problem. You used to have 38 bowl games, and 38 bowl games meant 76 teams. I can assure you that of the 17 teams remaining, if they only needed five to get to the magic six victory number this weekend, five out of the 17, in all likelihood, based on the matchups I've seen, can do it. Getting nine to do it out of 17, very, very hard. Texas needs to win twice to get there. Because remember, the Big 12 season extends into next weekend. While everyone else is playing conference championship games, the Big 12 season ends on a week from Saturday. Because they don't have a championship game, but they try to extend it out and have games next week. That's why the Big 12, they still have two games remaining. That's why Texas needs that back-to-back wins to get to the promised land. They're 4-6. Big problem in college football right now. I mean, finally, you've hit that limit. You have too many bowl games. There is not interest in seeing teams under 500 in bowl games. In the Big Ten, all the four top four Eastern teams are all settled. In terms of being in, Michigan State, Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State. There's nobody else in the East. Actually, it's not true. Actually, Indiana with a win can get there. Indiana with a win can get there. In the West, Nebraska, they play Friday against Iowa. Minnesota and Illinois, all at five wins, can get there. Nebraska has to play at Iowa. They're playing a lot better, Nebraska is right now. But Iowa, of course, playing for a lot. I was texting back and forth with Gary Dolphin, Iowa's outstanding play-by-play voice. And I'm trying to get Dolphin on the show next week, as a matter of fact. You know, that's a good idea. That would be a good idea. Let's get Dolphin on the show next week. All right. And, Kevin, you don't have to worry about that. I'll take care of that myself. Because I was asking Gary, we have to vote on the All-Big Ten team. And I want some advice from Gary as to which way I should be going, because obviously I didn't see Iowa in person this year. I've seen Iowa on tape, but not in person. I wanted to get Gary's feelings as to which way I should be leaning on my all-Big Ten vote when it comes to Iowa players. They're undefeated. They need to be well-represented, obviously, and I wanted to find out from him which direction to go in. So we're going to get Gary on the show next week. That'll be a great thing to have on the show. I'm looking forward to that. Dolph's one of the really great guys. I mean, they're all great guys in this conference. There's one guy in this conference in the other 13 schools I don't really like being around. I like being around all of them, including George Blaha, who's Michigan State, great guy. All right, Chris Soleri, Lansing State Journal, coming up next half hour to talk about this Michigan State story. We're in the Sunbury Motors studio, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, on News Radio 1070 WKOK. This year marks Sunbury Motor Company's 100th year in business, and we will be keeping the same tried and true values we've had ever since we opened our doors, guaranteeing your car buying experience will be smooth and hassle-free. No spinning a wheel for specials you don't need or want. No pushy sales staff pouncing on you as soon as you arrive. No sideshow yelling. Since we began back in 1915, we have strived to be your most trusted friend when it comes to all of your new car needs, whether that's in sales or service. We strive to offer you as many viable options as we possibly can. Sunbury Motor Company always carries a line of few other auto dealers in our area can compete with. With our inventory of Ford, Hyundai, Kia, and Lincoln vehicles, there should be no problems with finding the right vehicle to fit your needs. Our friendly and trustworthy staff is knowledgeable in all of our products and stand ready to answer all of your questions and meet all of your needs. In honor of 100 years in business, SMC is introducing the all-new Auto Club, where Sunbury Motors will pay you for every mile you drive. Be sure to ask us about our Auto Club benefits. Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza and at sunburymotors.com. Proudly owned by the Mertz family since 1915.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, we're headed to Thanksgiving here. Final half hour of the show. Yeah, I know they're Friday sponsored, but you know what? You have Thanksgiving coming up. Stop over at Brewer's Outlet, all right? Stock up now, all right? Figure I'd say that now. It's a preemptive Friday promo. Okay, time now for our Bozo of the Day. Jimmy Butler, Chicago Bulls. You're going to love this one. He says that Mason Plumlee needs to pay him $2,500. And here's the reason why. Butler plans to ask Mason Plumlee to pay his fine after Butler was called for a technical foul during the fourth quarter of the Bulls' 93-88 win over Portland when the two got tangled up. The play in question happened with 4:17 to go in the game. The Bulls were leading 80-79. Butler tried to set a pick, and it appeared that Plumlee dropped a shoulder into Butler that knocked him over. Butler responded by tripping Plumlee and going head-to-head with him as the pair exchanged some heated words before being separated. The referees reviewed the play, giving Plumlee a flagrant one and Butler a technical foul. That cost Butler $2,500 in fines. He says he's not happy about it, and he's going to request that Plumlee pay him the money because he says he's not paying the fine. Butler seemed more upset about the fine for the impending technical than he did for the actual play itself. He said he thought it was a football out there for a moment. It's all good, though, man. I almost had to let the Fort Greene projects out of me in Brooklyn. Butler's mention of Fort Greene was a reference to teammate Taj Gibson's hometown. Gibson was standing next to Butler as he spoke to the media. After a couple of moments of laughter, Butler said, basketball emotions, that's part of the game. But he is going to ask nicely for the money. He's going to ask the guy. He's going to ask Mason Plumlee to send him $2,500 to pay the fine. That is the definition of our Bozo of the Day. If you hadn't yapped at him, you wouldn't have received the technical and you wouldn't have been fined. It's amazing what self-discipline does. What a win for Michigan State Saturday as they beat Ohio State in Columbus. Chris Soleri, Lansing State Journal, joins us. Chris, I know it's the first time we've had you with us. Welcome to the show. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Yeah, it's great to be with you guys back in my home state.
Yeah. All right. Where are you from, Chris?
I'm from Butler, actually. I grew up
right
there. So I've been out this way for, a number of years now, 20 or so years, a little more than that.
Yeah, stationed in Butler carries our broadcast. So,
very
as a matter
good
of fact,
on the hello, Butler.
Yes. All right. So, Chris, let's outline this. Backup quarterback, playing on the road, defending national champion, and the one area where Michigan State's better this year than last year is giveaway, takeaway, and points off of that 72-3. And you lose that. How do they win the game?
Isn't that amazing? I mean, you saw an inspired effort from the front seven, I thought. And I think that there's some truth to what Ezekiel Elliott said after the game, that Ohio State didn't really try and take a lot of downfield shots. And I really thought that was going to be an issue in this game. I think Michigan State was expecting that. And really what they did in their play calling was allow Michigan State's back end to really come up and play and run support, tackle in space with Barrett and Miller and Elliott when they would try and get the edge. And they didn't allow them to do that. But there was no adjustments made. And it was an unbelievable defensive performance by Michigan State. I mean, you know, by far, I think Michigan State's best defensive performance this year, and maybe even in the last 2-3 years, you know, back to the Rose Bowl team. I mean, this was, you know, you're talking about holding Ezekiel Elliott to just 33 yards, holding Braxton Miller to 9 yards, holding JT Barrett to 44 yards. That's 86 total yards on the ground. I mean, this is an Ohio State team that uses that run to set up the pass, and when they couldn't set up the pass, they never tried. They only threw 16 passes. So, I mean, and the other thing I think you saw, too, on Michigan State's offensive line, they dominated. I mean, they dominated that game. I mean, they held the ball for 38-plus minutes, and that's how you win ball games, even if you're giving the ball away. Even if those two turnovers led to all 14 Ohio State points in short field, I mean, on drives that didn't total more than 30-some yards, that's how you saw Michigan State win.
Tyler O'Connor steps into a tough spot. It seemed like he played with a lot of poise. What did the players and the coaching staff tell you after the game about how he handled himself?
Well, what's funny is going into the week, you know, that there were so many rumors and questions about Connor Cook's shoulder that Michigan State continued to just duck and dodge. So I did a story, and the coaching staff was very pleased and happy with how O'Connor played, even though there weren't necessarily a lot of results in the Maryland game. But I think what you saw is that his ability to run was a game changer. You know, that was something that Ohio State's defense had struggled with. They struggled with Perry Hills from Maryland. They struggled with running quarterbacks all season. And by Cook being hurt, it may have helped Michigan State a little bit more, because both Cook and or both O'Connor and Damian Terry were able to get outside. I mean, they combined for 50 yards rushing. And that's with two sacks. So, I mean, you know, it was a difference maker, really. And I think O'Connor is a poised kid. He's been in the system. This is his fourth year as a redshirt junior, and really his first chance. I mean, it was a chance for him to go home to Ohio and win in front of the crowd. I mean, I thought the Michigan State players and coaches were supremely confident in both of those guys, both O'Connor and Terry. And really, O'Connor rose to the occasion on a wet, slick day.
I felt over the last 3 years or so that the Michigan State corners were so good that it allowed Michigan State to be better at the other nine positions and you could be more creative with them. What did it mean to get Hicks back in the lineup at that corner spot?
That's a huge, huge boost, because you don't see the rotation as much now. I mean, when they had to move Demetrius Cox, Pittsburgh kid, they moved him. I think he went to Jeanette High. He went to cornerback at the start of the year, but he's always been more of a natural safety. So they were trying to find a mix at cornerback, and then Hicks got hurt. Then Vontae Copeland got hurt, and then Hicks got hurt. So they had to play Cox more at cornerback. Arjun Colquhoun stepped up and played some pretty good football the last month and a half. But getting Hicks back really allowed them to slide Cox over to safety, allowed Cox and Nicholson, two Pennsylvania kids, to play down and run support and tackle in open space. And, I mean, I thought those two were difference makers in preventing Ohio State. There was one play around the left edge that Barrett kept the ball and looked like he was going to turn the corner, but Monte Nicholson bared down on him. And you know, if Monte Nicholson doesn't have Demetrius Cox next to him, I don't think he's playing with that kind of confidence and that kind of ability. And that all trickled back to Hicks coming back in the lineup. And, I mean, they didn't really throw at him that much. They didn't really test either. I mean, they tested Colquhoun one time, and he broke it up. It looked like it was going to be an interception as it fluttered down the field. So, I think what you're seeing now, though, with Michigan State, it's really the other way around. The way the front seven is playing, is really helping mask some of the issues and concerns that were there early in the year with the secondary. But secondary is starting to really play its own brand of football now.
Is Aaron Burbridge good enough to mask any problem in a passing game?
Boy, that's a tough call because he and Connor Cook have a special rapport.
Yeah.
I think he's a good enough receiver that you saw him make a couple curls and comeback routes that allowed O'Connor to do what he could. And then you saw the one play down the sideline that resulted in a pass interference call. So, right. I mean, you know, when you have that kind of receiver who's got speed down the field, the ability to run a variety of routes, he does have an ability to, you know, if it's O'Connor or if it's Terry in there, maybe cover up a little bit of their deficiencies that they haven't had the experience in throwing the ball. But boy, I mean, you know, their Michigan State didn't really take a lot of shots either. And the one deep shot they took was to the Garrett Kings with Damian Terry, and that went a little bit long. And they had the other pass that O'Connor completed for 36 yards as well. But, you know, and that was the Burbridge. That was on a play that right. very similar to the play that they lost to Nebraska, where he went out of bounds and came back in and made the catch, and pass interference was waved off.
Is there any real difference between Gerald Holmes, Madre London, and L.J. Scott?
I think difference versus separation are two different things.
Right.
I think they run all with different styles. Holmes is really aggressive. I think Holmes and Delton Williams, who's the number four back right now from Erie, those two run hard and violent and aggressive. You know, straight flying runners mostly. LJ Scott's more of a wiggle guy. He's got an upper body. Then you saw that in the final couple drives that he got the ball. He's got an incredible burst through the line, but he also has that escapability and wiggle kind of like Le'Veon Bell did. And Madre London, I mean, London had like a nice combination of both early in the year, but he's been beset with injury. You know, the ankle injury really hasn't healed up, and he didn't see a lot of carries. There wasn't much separation, I thought, until the injuries to Scott and Holmes, or Scott and London, really gave Holmes the chance. And right now he's running with power and force, but they're peppering in. They want to give LJ Scott the ball. He's a highly rated recruit, and you know, you saw that in that fourth quarter. He was kind of their closer and really got Michigan State down the field for that field goal drive.
How good a front four, and you've referenced the front seven several times, how good a front four are Calhoun, Heath, McDowell, and Thomas?
Well, I think after that game on Saturday, you also have to throw Craig Evans into the mix as well, because Heath couldn't go. But Craig Evans, redshirt freshman, came in and played a monster game as well. But McDowell, that defense goes with McDowell and really Lawrence Thomas and Calhoun. I mean, Calhoun is a guy that will draw double teams on the edge. McDowell is the guy that you have to start thinking about whether you can double him inside. Now that's all of a sudden, you know, you got to pick and choose between the two of those guys. And McDowell has been just playing out of his mind football the past couple weeks. And, you know, I think at Nebraska, Calhoun got a little frustrated because he was being held and didn't really play through some things. And I think he looked at that tape and realized where his deficiency was, because he's, you know, even if he's getting, you know, knocked over, dragged down, he's still playing through it. And I mean, I thought, you know, when you have guys like that, like Thomas and Calhoun, guys that are athletes that can get, you know, basically get outside or go rush you inside, that allows a guy like Malik McDowell to really shine in the middle of that defense.
Riley Bull is the latest in the line. What makes him good?
I don't necessarily think he has that computer brain like his brother Max, but I think he's got more speed. I think he's got, you know, he's a guy that was a running back here. When Michigan State was trying to find a running back, they moved him over to the offensive side of the ball. So he's got the athletic ability maybe a little bit more so than his brother, which I think helps. But he also has that intricate knowledge of the defense. He's got those guys in the right spot, making the right calls. And, you know, we weren't really sure how it would be this year with him in the middle taking over Tawan Jones. But, I mean, it's been a seamless, almost seamless progression from 2 years ago when Max was in the middle of that defense. And you know, I mean, you got a guy on the edge with him, with John Reschke, who's just flying around making plays. I mean, he's the Walter Camp National Defensive Player of the Year. He's a guy that wasn't expected to play much this year until Ed Davis's injury. And Darian Harris as well. I mean, all three of those linebackers right now are playing at such a supreme level. I mean, the three of them, 6-6 and 4 tackles in that game. I mean, that wasn't just, straightforward hitting the gaps. They were going on the edge and tracking down Elliott and Barrett Miller just as much as they were plugging up the middle. So, like I said earlier, I mean, the ability of that, having that front four and the three linebackers playing at that level really does help Michigan State hide some concerns in the secondary.
During Mark D'Antonio's time at Michigan State, they've had some darn good physical offensive lines. I know this line at times has been bumped up. When you watch them fire off the ball Saturday, what did you think?
Oh, it's by far, I think, if not the best thing, probably one of the top two or three performances in Mark D'Antonio's era by an offensive line. And that was what they said coming into the year, that this was going to be their best line in his 9 seasons. And, there were a couple injuries. You had Conklin out for a while. You lost Dennis Finley for the season. You had Keeler out. You had Jack Allen. I mean, this is a very banged-up group that took advantage of having a bye week to get a little healthier. And really, in a game where they needed them more than anything, I mean, I as much as the defense I thought played the best football, I thought they needed the offensive line in this game. And, you saw them blasting holes. I mean, there was that 20-yard run that really got them out from their goal line in the fourth quarter by L.J. Scott. I mean, that was set up by a pull by center Jack Allen that was as quick a footwork as you will see from an offensive line. This is a guy that 2 weeks ago couldn't play because of a bad ankle. So, I mean, this is the best that Michigan State's offensive line has played. Can they continue this and keep that up, though, is the question. And you haven't seen that this year. That was only the second time they ran for more than 200 yards this season. So, I mean, that's critical, especially with Connor Cook, still kind of questionable. I guess we'll find out a little more later in the week whether or not he can go this week. But they, without Connor Cook, they need the Michigan State's offensive line to step up, and they provide it.
What's your thoughts on Penn State with this one coming up Saturday?
I think it's an interesting game. I mean, Penn State obviously wants to play spoiler here, and they've had some back and forth games over the years in November that have been meaningful games for both teams. But I think this is maybe it's one of the best games coming up between these two schools in the 23 years since they resumed the series.
Right.
I expect Hackenberg to try and take some shots downfield on them that Ohio State did. So maybe we will see a little bit more of what Michigan State's secondary has been this year. And I think that's going to be the key. If Hackenberg can make some plays downfield, Penn State has a chance to come in here and get the upset.
When Penn State got into this conference, Chris, a few years back, 23 years ago, George Perlis called Joe Paterno and he said, "Hey, look, how about we make this the last game of the season? Because obviously Michigan's not going to play them the last game and Ohio State's not going to play them the last game." And wanted to get something going. Now, last year, this year, and I think next year is the last game, then it kind of rotates through after that. Is it a good thing to make this one the last game of the year on a consistent basis, or is there a better school that Michigan State should be facing?
Well, the thing to me that needs to go away is that trophy.
It's got that right. That is a monstrosity. Oh, man. Anytime you need four people to carry something, it's not good.
I mean, it's one of those classic. I mean, it looks like a trophy out of the 90s. I mean, really it is. I mean, it's a wooden metal thing. There's no history or value to it. And I think that neither program really talks about it all that much. But, a lot of that goes back to George's time with the Pittsburgh Steelers and a lot of the big players that Michigan State has had from the Pittsburgh area throughout Duffy Doherty's era, throughout the 70s, and then into George's era. And, I mean, now you got guys like Paul Lang and Monte Nicholson and Demetrius Cox here. Damian Terry's from Erie. Delton Williams is from Erie. So, I mean, Michigan State has always had significant ties to especially Western Pennsylvania. I mean, obviously Jeff Smoker as well, another Pennsylvania kid that has a place in Michigan State history, whatever that place may be. But, I think that there's enough ties that it does make a good amount of sense, especially considering you're not going to get Michigan or Ohio State at the end of the year. And that's, the reality is if Michigan State could get Michigan at the end of the year in the last game, I think Michigan State would love that. But, the people down in Ann Arbor and really the people in Columbus wouldn't allow that to happen.
Right.
Because for 40-some years, that's been the game. And now, I think last week you kind of saw what has been the game in the last you know, 5 or 6 years, Michigan State, Ohio State.
Right. I think for the Big Ten moving forward, I think this past weekend, based on the TV ratings, because Penn State, Michigan was the highest rated noon game of the year for ABC, and Ohio State, Michigan State was off the charts as well. I think that should send them a message as to how you should schedule the last two weekends of the season, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think if you look around, just take a look at what these two games for both teams the past 2 weeks. I mean, there's been important games, and you know, not just for the division, but nationally. And I think that you see that in the Big 12. They're playing a round robin right now for their league championship, and eyes are focused on them. You know, now in this divisional structure for the Big Ten, you have to do that. I mean, especially, you know, you do that with those four teams. You know, you've got Nebraska and Minnesota on the other side that are
Iowa.
Kind of up there right now in Iowa. You know, if you're able to do that and create interest down the stretch, I mean, that's what you want. That's what your TV partners want.
Do you think that with Jim Harbaugh, Urban Meyer, James Franklin, and Mark D'Antonio, that's going to change over the years? Those are still going to be the four best teams in the division.
Yeah, I think so as well. I mean, you know, it'll be interesting to me to see after this week which game gets more eyeballs, whether the Michigan-Ohio State game or Michigan State-Penn State, because, like I said, there's so much significance riding on this game, obviously a Big Ten title. They're going head-to-head with each other time-wise, so it should be interesting.
Chris, real pleasure. Thanks so much. Great to have a little Western Pennsylvania flavor on from East Lansing.
Hey, anytime. You know, give me a call.
Chris Solari, Lansing State Journal. All right, time to wrap it up. Thankful for so many things, the great audience, the show. Kevin is unbelievable to work with. Yeah, I may kid him all the time, but unbelievable to work with. Thankful to have a great working partner on the air that does such a great job for family, for friends, for great work, and, yeah, everything that we do here. So thankful. Be safe. We'll talk to you Friday here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.